business monopoly. The Ways and Means Committee decided to tax the business income of organizations now exempt. That's the business earnings of labor unions, agricultural, educational, charitable organizations, and so on.
A great deal of the talk about this program has concerned military strength. This is an essential element, but it is not by itself sufficient. The military strength of the free world must be adequate to deter Soviet leaders from any rash adventure. But this effort must be accompanied by other elements of strength, economic, political, and moral. Only in this way will the free world be able to resist the external threat of Soviet military power and the internal threat of subversion by the international communist movement. This, then, is the course we have chosen. To preserve the peace and our essential values in the only realistic way it can be done, by strengthening the free world to prevent aggression, and by cooperating with all friendly nations in advancing our common welfare. Now, the needs of this program for strengthening the free world are different in different parts of the world. And I should like to speak for a few minutes more tonight about one of these areas, the part of the world which we have come to call the North Atlantic Community. The 12 nations of the North Atlantic Community include about 337 million people, about one-sixth of the world's population. Within this area is the world's greatest concentration of industrial and technical skills. This community of nations is also brought together by a common political experience, the growth of the idea of the freedom and the rights of man. So geography, political experience, and industrial capacity join to make the North Atlantic Community a natural and a critically important grouping of states. By common action on their mutual problems of defense, of economic development, of political cooperation, the North Atlantic states can achieve a substantial increase of their combined strength. And in doing so, they increase the strength of the entire free world. So our support for the strengthening of the North Atlantic Community does not imply any lessening of our interest or our commitments in other parts of the world. In fact, on the contrary, it reflects the keystone role which this combination of states must play in strengthening the security and the welfare of the entire free world. The meetings of the North Atlantic Council in London, from which I have just returned, mark an important stage in the development of the North Atlantic Community. It constituted a step forward in our program to preserve the peace. When I reported to the president on my return, I spoke to him of two clear impressions, which more than anything else stood out as a result of these meetings. The first of these is that the North Atlantic Community is emerging as a political reality of the greatest importance. The other impression which I carried away from these discussions was the new vigor of European life and of European leadership. There was a sense of confidence and of vitality. There was a firm determination to join with us in exercising initiative to secure the peace. I returned from Europe with a renewed sense of confidence that we shall be able to establish the conditions of peace. One of the steps that we agreed to take was to set up a full-time council of deputies. We found that the two or three meetings a year which the foreign ministers have had didn't give us enough continuity or control of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The Council of Deputies will be able to function on an everyday basis. One of these deputies will be chosen to act as the permanent chairman, permanent director of the whole organization, and he will be responsible for directing all the work of the council. And having in mind the great importance of the Council of Deputies, we hope to send is our American representative, a man of the highest caliber, and we hope to give him the full support of our government, and we hope that all the people of the United States will also give him their full support. Now, there were several points in connection with the defense arrangements and the economic plans which were made at the London meetings, which I ought to mention to you. There is one which Senator Connolly has mentioned to you earlier and which is absolutely vital to an understanding of the defense of the free world. And that is that our European friends are not interested in a defense plan which would let their countries be overrun to be liberated at some other date. And you wouldn't be interested in that sort of a plan either. So what is necessary to be done is for the North Atlantic community to develop a defense force sufficient to meet successfully any initial attack and to carry through to a successful conclusion any war which is forced upon us. Only if this is true, only if this is done, will the force be strong enough to be a deterrent against aggression. And the primary purpose of the North Atlantic Treaty is to prevent war. It is only its secondary purpose to win a war if a war is forced upon us. But the very primary, essential, and vital purpose of that treaty is peace. It is to prevent a war from occurring. Now, this force has got to be armed with the most modern defensive weapons capable of mass production. For only in this way will it be able to match any potential aggressor. Not man for man, but in sheer power of defense. To do this is going to require a very great effort indeed, and it is to that effort that we must dedicate ourselves. Particularly, it is going to be important that waste and duplication be avoided so that this great task will not interfere with another great task which we must perform, and that is to provide for our own peoples and all the peoples of the North Atlantic community, each providing for its own people adequate standards of living. We must move forward with the necessities for defense, and we must maintain standards of living. And so to this end, the ministers who met in London endorsed the principle of what they called balanced collective forces. Now, this is what you would call in Texas an all-star team. It means that each member nation contributes the kind of force to the common defense which it can best contribute, and that this should be done in accordance with a common plan. In this way, each nation does not have to duplicate all the expensive components of modern armed forces. The integrated strength of this team will be stronger than that which any of us could achieve alone, and the savings and the avoidance of duplication will reduce the burdens on all our economies. Now, the United States has necessarily a leading role in setting up this defense team. These agreements will not mean anything unless we follow them up with action. One step which is essential to the success of this effort is the matter, again, which was referred to by Senator Connolly, and the matter which he is piloting with such skill and with such vigor through the Senate at this very time, and that is the renewal of the Mutual Defense Assistance Program for another year. And it carries an authorization of an appropriation in the neighborhood of $1.25 billion. This program is absolutely essential to the establishment of conditions of peace and of stability in the world. It's also necessary to the fulfillment of our part of the defense system that we maintain our own defenses at an adequate level. And in this connection, adequate means that it shall be sufficient for our defense purposes, because we have no aggressive intentions whatever. Another point which should be emphasized is that we cannot allow ourselves, in building the necessary defense force, to put an undue burden on living standards. The economic aspects of our program of strengthening the free world are of equal importance with the military aspects. As I said a moment ago, the military part of our program has received the most attention, perhaps because the military threat is the most easily dramatized and understood. But a continued improvement in living standards and a continued progress in social gains in the free world is no less a part of our program. This must be so, first because it is central to our objective of building a peaceful world, and secondly because it is essential to the defense against subversion by the international communist movement. In many ways, the job we face in the economic field is the most difficult. Dislocations resulting from the war, from Soviet behavior, and from the shifting patterns of power in the world have destroyed the old economic balance and relationships. It is necessary that new economic relationships be established. The states of Western Europe and the North Atlantic Community must have the economic strength required to fulfill their security requirements and to provide a proper standard of living for their people. To have this, they will have to increase their productivity. They will have to open new channels and markets, provide for the conversion and balancing of their currencies, provide for additional sources of capital investment, and for assistance to underdeveloped areas. To meet all these difficult problems, a network of organizations has been and is being developed. Many of these organizations sound remote and complicated, but they are of vital concern, not only to the prosperity of Europeans, but to the well-being of all of us in this auditorium tonight. The progress which was made in London towards setting up a European Payments Union was most important. The Payments Union will operate as a clearinghouse so that people living in different currency areas will be able to trade with one another. And this will help to develop a European mass market. We hope that this step toward breaking down barriers in the European trading area will help to raise productivity and standards of living. Another major advance was made during the three power talks we held with the British and French before the meetings of the North Atlantic Council began. This was the proposal put forward by Mr. Schuman for the joint utilization of the coal and steel resources of France and Germany, as well as those of other European countries who wish to participate. This proposal represents a courageous and an imaginative step forward in dealing with ancient rivalries and prejudices. Six countries will, within a few days, begin their efforts to perfect the details of this plan. If they are successful, it will open the possibility of the solution of many old and very dangerous problems. These two steps alone, the Schuman proposal and the European Payments Union, if they materialize along constructive lines, hold the promise of a great new era for Europe. The vitality and the imagination reflected in Mr. Schuman's proposal and the energy with which it is being developed are manifestations of the new tone in Europe, of which I spoke to you a few moments ago. This spirit indicates a European determination to work hard toward its own recovery and security. The birth of this spirit has been materially assisted by American aid, chiefly through the Marshall Plan. To cooperate with us in this effort, 18 European nations have set up an organization for European economic cooperation. That was set up, as you remember, at the very beginning of the Marshall Plan. And this organization has shown a great usefulness. And recently it is decided, and the wisdom of that decision is very great, that it should not terminate in 1952. Now, it was also clear to us in our meetings in Europe that our American interest in Europe was not possibly going to terminate in 1952 either, because we were partners in this great Atlantic community upon which the security of the whole free world depended. And so we had discussions as to a working relationship.